The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I am honored to introduce our guests this evening. In his 2021 number one New York Times bestselling book, How the Word is Passed, Clint Smith takes the reader on a tour of monuments and landmarks that examines the legacy of slavery in America and how history and memory shape our everyday lives. Among a raft of other honors, the book won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. He is also the author of the poetry collection Counting Descent, which won the 2017 Literary Award for Best Poetry Book from the Black Caucus of the American Library Association, and was a finalist for an NAACP Image Award. He is a former National Poetry Slam champion, and his new poetry collection, Above Ground, will be published in March 2023. This evening, he will be joined in conversation with award-winning journalist and broadcaster Tracy Matisak. Please join me in welcoming Clint Smith and Tracy Matisak to the Free Library.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for sharing your Thursday evening with us. We're delighted to see so many of you here with us in person, and of course, thrilled to have Clint Smith with us tonight. So as we always do, we've budgeted some time for your questions toward the end of our evening together. So be thinking about that now, and we'll take as many questions as we can. We've usually got staff members with microphones, so you can just raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you to get your question answered. But that said, Clint Smith, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
It's good to be here. Thank you all so much for coming out.
So for this book, How the Word is Passed, you visited multiple spots in the United States. You went over to Africa as well to take a look at how the story of slavery is communicated or not in different ways. What prompted the journey?
So in 2017, I was watching several Confederate statues come down in my hometown in New Orleans, statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee. And as I was watching these statues come down, I was thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And what are the implications of that? What does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Parkway? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That my parents still live on a street today, named after someone who owned over 150 enslaved people? Because the thing is, we know that symbols and names and iconography aren't just symbols. They're reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which isn't to say that you just take down a 60-foot-tall statue of Robert E. Lee and you erase the racial wealth gap, or you take down a bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest and you create more equitable schools. But it does help us recognize the ecosystem of ideas and stories and narratives that help shape our understanding of American history and help shape our understanding of the ways that certain communities have been disproportionately and intentionally harmed throughout American history. And so I started looking around New Orleans and started trying to examine, well, what are the places that are telling the story honestly? What are the places that are running away from their responsibility to tell this story? And what are some of the places that are doing something sort of in between? And thinking about what does it mean for me that I grew up as the descendant of enslaved people and had no idea what it and had so little of a conception of what it meant to be born in a place that was the former heart of the domestic slave trade, that was at one point the largest, busiest slave market in the country, and recognizing that I didn't understand the history of slavery in any way that was commensurate with this impact and legacy that it left on my city, on my state, on my country. And part of what I wanted to do was fill those gaps within myself. And I wanted to write the sort of book that I felt like I needed in my high school American history class, the sort of book that would have given me the language, the toolkit, the information with which to more effectively make sense of the city I grew up in, to more effectively make sense of the country I grew up in, that would have helped me understand that, you know, the reason one community looks one way and another community looks another way is not because of the people in those communities, but is because of what has been done to those communities or taken away from those communities generation after generation after generation, beginning with chattel slavery.
Yeah. You started off at Thomas Jefferson's home in Monticello, or Monticello, if you like, in Virginia. And one of the things that you found there was that there were a lot of people who did not know that our third president sold, leased, and mortgaged human beings, and lots of them, and that he had fathered multiple children with Sally Hemings, who was also enslaved. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the author of the Declaration of Independence, which says that all men are created equal, was able to reconcile that ideal with the fact that he owned something like 200 human beings?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to start the book at Monticello was because I think that Jefferson in so many ways personifies the cognitive dissonance of the American project, which is to say that America is a place that has provided unparalleled, unimaginable opportunities for millions of people across generations in ways that their own ancestors could have never imagined. And it's also done so at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people who have been intergenerationally subjugated and oppressed. And both of those things are the story of America. It's not one over here and one over there, or you get to pick this one and not pick that one. Both of them are the story of this country, and they're both deeply entangled in one another. And I think Jefferson, again, sort of embodies the moral inconsistencies of America in the sense that he is someone who wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world and is also someone who enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children. He's someone who wrote in notes in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal and wrote in notes on the state of Virginia that black people are inferior to whites in both endowments of body and mind, as he put it. He said the slave was incapable of love, incapable of possessing or sustaining complex emotion to the same extent that their white counterparts were. Talked about Phyllis Wheatley, the sort of foremother of African-American letters, the first black woman to publish a book of poetry in the history of the United States. He said that her work was below the dignity of criticism, that it wasn't even worth engaging with because he didn't believe that black people had the necessary artistic and emotional acumen with which to create beautiful things. So he was like, we can call that something else, but we shouldn't call it poetry because black people don't possess the creative capacity with which to create beautiful things. And so I think about that, and what I wanted to understand was how does this place, this institution, this museum, this historical site that is tasked with communicating and conveying and cultivating the legacy of Jefferson, how do they tell the story of who this man was? Do they tell the sort of two-dimensional rendering of it that I received when in my education, that sort of talked about Jefferson sort of singularly as the intellectual founding father of this country, as someone upon upon whom no aspersion should be cast, the sort of mythological, larger-than-life figure? Or did they talk about a man who was deeply inconsistent in what he espoused, deeply inconsistent in what he practiced, who knew that slavery was wrong, who wrote extensively about how slavery was more morally harmful to the enslaver than it was to the enslaved, and yet continued to enslave people over the course of his life anyway, continued to have impregnate a woman, a black woman, on his plantation and have her bear his children. And so I was curious what sort of choices an institution like that makes, and how is the story Monticello tells today, how does that compare to the story they told 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? So that's one of the interesting things about Monticello, is that it represents the idea that these historical sites aren't static, and that they're not how you once told the story doesn't have to be how you tell the story forever. Because how Monticello told the story 20 years ago is light years away from how they tell the story now, which isn't to say that they're perfect, but it is to say that it's an institution that recognizes it has a particular responsibility as perhaps the most famous plantation in the world by nature of the person who owned that land, to communicate the complexity and the totality of what happened there. And when we talk about Monticello, to talk not only about Jefferson, but to also talk about the lives and the emotional texture of the hundreds of enslaved people who lived there, to whom that land belonged to as much, if not more, than it belonged to Jefferson.
Yeah. So the story has evolved in the right direction over the years, but there was something that your tour guide, David, said that to me seemed like a thread that ran through the book when he said, there's, you know, history and there's nostalgia and somewhere in between is memory.
Right.
Can you unpack that a little bit?
That's the thing about writing nonfiction and finding characters like David is that they say things in like a much more magical and cooler way than you ever could. And be like, David, like the past is complicated. And he's like, nostalgia, history. And in the middle, they conjure and like, you know, little embers spark into the air when he said, and then there's memory. David was such a fascinating person. I was so lucky I got to encounter him because when I went on that tour, the Slavery in Monticello tour, he, you know, he's this older white guy, so this large brown brimmed hat, big Oxford shirt, khaki pants, very professorial disposition. And we were there, and there were about a dozen of us on the tour. And I, you know, he started talking about all of the sort of things that I had alluded to before, the moral inconsistencies of Jefferson, the things that he said versus the things that he did, the things that he wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia, a lot of the racist language that's that can be found in so many of his letters. And there were these two women, Donna and Grace, and I remember watching them as we were on our tour, and as David was sort of outlining all of these other parts of Jefferson that many people don't always know about. Their faces turned white, their faces were wilting, their mouths hung agape. And I went up to them after, and I was like, it looks like you were really emotionally affected by what David was saying in his presentation. I'd love to hear some of what you're thinking. And I'll always remember Donna turned to me, and she was just like, man, he really took the shine off the guy. She's just like... She's like, I had no idea Monticello was a plantation. I had no idea Jefferson was, owned slaves. And mind you, these are folks who bought plane tickets, rented cars, got hotel rooms, who came to this site as a sort of pilgrimage to see the home of one of our founding fathers and yet had no idea that he was an enslaver. And that was such an important moment for me, especially at the beginning of the book, because it helped remind me that there are so many, even in a moment where it feels like our collective conception of our founding and of our history has shifted dramatically, which it has, that there are still millions of people across this country who have no sense of the relationship that slavery played in the founding of this country, the sort of economic and political and social development of this country, and in the relationship and the sort of interpersonal lives of the founders themselves.
Yeah. You spent time in your home state of Louisiana, and you visited at least two places there that tell completely different stories about their connection to slavery. Of course, one was Angola, the notorious prison that's built on a plantation, functioning in many ways as a modern-day kind of plantation. What did you come away with from Angola about how they tell or do not tell that story?
For those who might not be familiar, Angola is the largest maximum security prison in the country, 18,000 acres wide, bigger than the island of Manhattan. It's a place where 75% of the people held there are black men, over 70% of them are serving life sentences, and it's built on top of a former plantation. And I was in Germany. I spent the past year traveling to and from Germany for a big story that I wrote for The Atlantic that came out a few months ago, exploring how Germany memorializes the Holocaust and putting into conversation how the United States memorializes or fails to memorialize chattel slavery. And I remember standing in Dachau, the first concentration camp that Germany built, that the SS built. And it's this vast, haunting expanse of gray, empty land. And you look to your left, you see the remnants of the crematorium. You look to your right, you see the remnants of the barracks. And I closed my eyes and I tried to do this thought exercise and just imagine what it would be like if on that land they built a prison. And in that prison, the vast majority of the people held there were Jewish. And I couldn't even finish the thought exercise because it was so viscerally upsetting. It was so morally abhorrent in a way that would, like, that place would so clearly be a global emblem of anti-Semitism. We would never allow such a place to exist, rightfully so. And yet here in the United States, we have the largest maximum security prison in the country where the vast majority of people are black men serving life sentences, many of whom were sentenced as children. The United States is the only country in the world that sentences children to life without the possibility of parole, many of whom were sentenced by non-unanimous juries, which has since been rendered unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States for being an explicit vestige of white supremacy, who work in fields, picking crops, sometimes cotton, while someone watches over them on horseback with a gun over their shoulder. And so part of what I'm trying to explore in the chapter are what are the specific manifestations of anti-Black racism in the United States that allow for that place to exist in that way, on that land, given what the history of that space is. And I think about, and what does it mean that Angola has a gift shop? And that at that gift shop, you can buy coffee mugs and shot glasses and baseball caps and stuffed animals dressed in prison garb. And on some of the baseball caps and some of the T-shirts you can buy, there's the silhouette of a watchtower. And above and below the watchtower, it reads, Angola, a gated community, as if to make a mockery of or belittle the experiences of the thousands of people, the tens of thousands of people across generations who've been incarcerated there, who've died there. And I was there with a guy named Norris, and Norris Henderson was incarcerated in Angola for almost 30 years, and he's been out of prison since 2003, so coming up on his 20th year of freedom. And he's been deeply involved and in many ways leading the effort of prison reform in both Louisiana and across the country. And I was there, and we were leaving the prison, and we were on this bus, and in the distance, we saw the sort of distant silhouettes of these men who were working in the fields, and they were lifting their garden hose into the air and digging them into the earth, lifting their shovels into the air and digging them into the earth, lifting their spades into the air and digging them into the earth. And Norris looked at the men, and then he looked at me, and he sort of opened his hands, and his hands had these calluses on them from all these years he spent working in the fields. And he was like, Clint, I can't begin to explain to you what it felt like to pick cotton for 7 cents an hour and wonder if my ancestors had picked cotton in the same field 200 years ago. Right? So for the people who are incarcerated in Angola, this history is not a metaphor. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's not an abstraction. It's in their bodies. It's in their bones. It's in the calluses in their hands. It's, as the scholar Sadia Hartman talks about, it's the afterlife of slavery and how the afterlife and the remnants and the residue of slavery continue to shape our social, political, and economic infrastructure in profound ways, and perhaps most directly shape our carceral infrastructure in very direct and profound ways.
Yeah. Our audience may remember that we had Albert Woodfox here a few years ago.
Incredible
when
book.
His book
Incredible
came
book.
Out. He passed away not too long ago, sadly, but he was here on the stage to talk about his experience at Angola. You also visited the Whitney Plantation, completely different experience, and it tells a very different story about slavery in the United States. And I was particularly struck, Clint, by your description of the children of the Whitney. Mm. If you could take us back to that day when you walked into the church that's on the grounds there and tell us what you saw.
You know, the Whitney is a place that is so, it plays such an important role in part because it is the only plantation site in Louisiana that explicitly centers the story of how it tells itself on the experiences of the enslaved people who once lived there. And it's surrounded by a sort of constellation of plantations where people continue to hold weddings and hold parties and debutante balls. And, you know, I was talking to some wedding planners, and they talk about how some of the old slave cabins at some of these wedding sites are now used as bridal suites when people have their weddings. And the Whitney is a place that fundamentally rejects the idea that a plantation can be understood as anything other than an intergenerational site of torture. Like, we don't often talk about slavery in terms of torture. We don't often talk about plantations in the context of being torture sites. But that is what they was. They were sites of intergenerational physical and psychological torture. And I think the role that children play in the storytelling process that the Whitney has, they have these sort of renderings of small clay children sort of scattered throughout the space, and they're using a lot of excerpts and quotes from the Federal Writers Project slave narratives between 1936 and 1938 when the U.S. captured, or we went, as part of the New Deal, we had an effort to capture the stories of enslaved people who were still living in the late 1930s. There were hundreds of thousands of enslaved people still living at that time. And that is some of the only firsthand accounts we have of people who lived through slavery who aren't Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman or the like. And they're so important because of that, even though they have their own sort of historical limitations. But what I think about is, you know, when I learned about slavery as a kid, and I think when I was made to understand the horror of what slavery was, it was largely through the prism of, like, the physical brutality and the spectacle of physical brutality, the beatings and the whippings and the hangings. And you know, you think about some of the most famous movie scenes or film renderings or television scenes tied to slavery, you know, most of them are part of what they are depicting is that specific spectacle of brutality. You think of the famous scene in Roots where Kunta Kinte is being beaten and said and made to say that his name is Toby. And so I think that that exists in our collective imaginations as the, when we think about the violence of slavery, that is what we first think of. And as we, you know, we were talking in the back, I have a 5- and a 3-year-old. And as I was working on this book, there were, you know, much younger versions of that, you know, just a baby and a young toddler. And I don't think I ever fully understood the totality of the violence of slavery until I had kids, specifically in the context of family separation. And so I remember being at the Whitney and standing in that church and standing particularly in one of the old slave cabins, one of the original slave cabins that they had, you know, standing there 200 years ago. And you're walking through this small cabin and you can hear your feet, you know, the wood moan under your feet, and you see the sun sort of sneak in through the cracks in the roof. And I tried to imagine, you know, the enslaved family who once lived there. And I tried to imagine what it would be like if I put my kids to bed one night and then I went to bed myself and I woke up the next day and my children were gone. And I had no idea where they went. I had no idea who had taken them. I had no idea if I would ever see them again. And it's a sort of unfathomable sort of emotional terrain to even step into. And then you have this moment where you realize that that was an omnipresent threat that hung over generations of enslaved people's lives every single day. That at any moment, you could be stripped away from your husband, your wife, your children, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, for no reason at all. And it's a sort of psychological terror, like the ubiquity of that threat, mm-hmm. how it hung over you every single moment of your life, is a psychological torture that I don't know that we take seriously enough when we are examining the fullness of what the torture and horror of slavery was like. And that is what I was left wrestling with and considering the most after I left Whitney was the not only the impact that it has on children, but the impact that the threat of losing your children, how that would shape the decisions that you make or don't make every day.
Speaking of the children, I would love for you to read a short passage from your time at the Whitney where you came across the angel statue.
I walked with Yvonne to an area of the plantation called the Field of Angels, which was built to honor the lives of 2,200 enslaved children who died here in St. John the Baptist Parish between 1823 and 1863. The plot of land has been made into a small brick courtyard surrounded by black granite plaques that were about waist high and that listed the children's names. The center of the courtyard, on an elevated pillar, was a statue of a woman down on one knee. Her chest was bare, and a pair of large wings jutted out from just under her shoulder blades on her back. A heavily creased cloth was draped loosely around her midsection, falling over her legs to the ground near her feet. Her hair was pulled back into several thick rows of braids, tugged horizontally across each side of her scalp. Her neck was smooth and curved, while her head was bent, eyes cast downward, looking at the limp body of the small child in her hands. My own son was a few months from turning 2 at the time, while his baby sister was only a couple weeks away from making her way into the world. This artist's rendering of the child, cradled in the angel's hands, evoked from me something I was unprepared for. I felt the blood leave my fingers and arrow toward my heart. I felt the saliva bubble up in the back of my throat and the space around me swollen with grief I could not name. I had to actively push out of my head the image of my own child in those hands. I had to remind myself to breathe because I realized I had not. These are the death records, names, dates, and times that they died, how old they were when they died, Yvonne said. And if all the information was recorded, you also see the name of their mom. Most of the children here died as toddlers, died very young. She scanned the names on the granite slabs. Most of them died from malnutrition and disease. We do know, through others, that sometimes enslaved women would kill their own children because they didn't want them to grow up in the system. But we can't officially say that here, because we don't know why these children died. But that is something that we do see in this history. Women making this really, really unimaginable decision because they understand, especially if they have young girls, what it would be like for them.
Thank you so much. The book is so powerful, and I just wanted you to have a flavor of what it sounds like. And in the interests of time, Clint, there's so many things that I want to ask you about, but I want to fast forward a little bit to Blandford Cemetery, which was yet another, had another way of telling or not telling the story in Petersburg, Virginia. It's also one of the largest mass graves of Confederate soldiers there. Plenty of nostalgia.
Yeah.
And what I was struck by, there were many things that I was struck by, but certainly the ongoing myth of the lost cause and that there were black men who fought for the Confederacy, and all of this is sort of promulgated there. And you got wind of an event, a Memorial Day event, I think it was the Sons of Confederate Veterans. So you saw this pamphlet while you were there and you picked it up and decided, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to picture you at this Memorial Day Confederate event. What happened?
Yeah. You know what's funny is that like this wasn't, that wasn't something that was written in my proposal. That wasn't something, if I was writing out my book proposal and I was like, and then on Thursday, I'm going to go spend the day with the Sons of Confederate Veterans at the largest Confederate graveyard in the country. My wife wouldn't let me out the door. And it's interesting because I thought I was going to write a chapter on Civil War battlefields. And so I went to Petersburg, Virginia, and I was getting this tour of this Civil War battlefield that was one of the primary sites of the Siege of Petersburg toward the end of the war, sort of last stand before the Confederate surrender. And I was having a conversation with the National Park Ranger, because it's a national park site, about my project. And he was like, oh, this sounds amazing. Like, you should go to this Confederate cemetery down the road. And it's like in the movies where there's like the angel and the devil who appear on your shoulder, except it's like regular Clint and writer Clint. And so regular Clint is like, we are absolutely not going to this Confederate cemetery. What are you talking about? And writer Clint is like, we gotta go, we gotta go. And I remember I went to the Confederate Cemetery, and I was getting a tour. And it was, as I talk about in the book, there was a conspicuous absence of discussion of the Confederacy. So bizarre, because there were Confederate flags everywhere, right? It's almost like, it's like being in a, I don't know, maybe, but maybe it's not. I was going to say it's like being in an aquarium and like nobody's talking about the fish, but like maybe, I guess the fish are used to each other, but like, you know, it was that in and of itself was also so conspicuous in its absence. And it, you know, part of what I wondered throughout so many of these sites was how different was the tour or the conversation because I was black, and what would it look different if I wasn't, like what is said when I'm not present. Mm-hmm. And so I went, you know, I had that tour. And then went to the visitor center where I was in conversation with the director of the center. And, you know, I was, as you mentioned, I was, you know, we were having this conversation and I looked sort of in my peripheral vision, I saw on the counter in between us this stack of flyers. And I was like, oh, what's that? And I kind of looked over and it was like a man with a thick handlebar mustache and a big Confederate flag behind him. And it was like Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. And I looked in and I like went to pick it up and she like threw her hand on the thing and then like grabbed it and kind of dramatically threw it. She was like, I don't know what that is. Who are those people? Like, that's weird. I was like, ma'am, you're the director of the site. Like, what are you talking? And so that was another moment where regular Clint and writer Clint appear on your shoulders. And writer Clint is like, we have to go to this. We have to go spend the day with the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And regular Clint is like, your wife is going to kill you. But I did get permission from my wife to go. And it was this really fascinating experience because it was unsettling, it was strange, it was disorienting, but it was also incredibly clarifying because it helped me understand that for so many people, history is not about primary source documents or empirical evidence. It's a story that they're told. Mm-hmm. It's a story that they tell. It's an heirloom that's passed down across generations. It's something where loyalty takes precedence over truth. In the chapter, I talk about a guy I met named Jeff. And Jeff, you know, again, had this... He had this handlebar mustache, this long salt and pepper ponytail, this round belly, this Confederate biker vest. And, you know, he was talking to me about how when he was a kid, his grandfather brought him to the cemetery. and his grandfather, they would go sit in this beautiful gazebo at the center of the cemetery, and his grandfather would play his banjo and play the old Dixie anthem and would tell him stories about the men who were buried in this field, and he would say, you know, these men didn't fight a war over slavery, these men didn't fight secede over slavery or secede over anything other than the right to have their own land, have their own property, you know, the states' rights, state sovereignty, you know, protect themselves against the war of northern aggression, protect themselves from these Yankees. And as he's telling him these stories and watch, you know, playing these songs, they're watching the sky turn from blue to orange to purple to black, watching the fireflies emerge from the forest and sort of hop from one tombstone to the next, watching deers come out and graze around the tombstone, these very sentimental, emotionally textured memories. And Jeff would tell me about how he tells, you know, now he brings his own granddaughters to that same cemetery. Mm-hmm. And he sings the same songs that his grandfather sang to him and tells the same stories that his grandfather sang to him and tells the same stories about the people who were buried in this field to his granddaughters. And so if I were to go to Jeff and be like, Jeff, man, look, like, I know your granddad told you that secession had nothing to do with slavery, but all you have to do is look at the Declarations of Confederate Secession, where the, you know, a state like Mississippi in 1861 says, our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest in the world. They're not vague about why they're seceding from the Union. They're very clear about it. Yeah. But for Jeff, if he is to accept that information, he would have to accept that his grandfather is lying to him. And if he has to accept that his grandfather was lying to him, it threatens to disintegrate the foundation upon which his relationship with this person that he loves, yeah. this person who's also a microcosm of a much larger community that he loves that also shaped him and shaped his identity. And so if that relationship disintegrates and his belief in what he's been told via that relationship disintegrates, it's not just a sort of inconvenient need to reassess his relationship to American history. It's like an existential crisis. Yeah. It's a crisis of identity. And I think that part of what I learned in my time there is like you have to take that component of it seriously. Mm-hmm. Like it would be very easy for me to have gone there and sort of make them all caricatures of bigotry and lost cause ideology, you know, with these harmful, bigoted, violent beliefs. And it's not to excuse the beliefs or to say that they aren't harmful, aren't bigoted, aren't grounded in a sort of ahistoricism. But you also have to take seriously that it is animated by like something deeply emotionally complex within people, something that is deeply tied to people's sense of themselves and sense of who they are in relation to the world. And so that's part of why I think we see so much pushback today, you know, in the form of like the critical race theory boogeyman and, you know, state legislatures that are now attempting to prevent teachers from teaching the very history that explains why our society looks the way that it does today. Libraries and school boards that are attempting to prevent teachers and libraries from sharing books with students that provide historical accounts that they otherwise might not encounter. All of that is animated by this profound sense of fear. And that fear comes from a fear of losing one's identity. Because the story of America that we've been told, that's been propagated through so much of our lives, is now being challenged and is being expanded, right? We're recognizing that there is a much fuller, more honest, more empirically grounded story about this country. And that's scary for people because their identities are deeply entangled in the previous story of America. And so when you challenge the previous story of America, people understand it as a challenge to themselves. Yeah. And so I think the Confederate Cemetery and that time there was a specific manifestation of what that fear looked like and why there was such a reluctance to let go of information or ideas or history, even when there's all of this evidence that demonstrates how misguided and false that history is.
Yeah. So many more questions that I could ask you, but if you didn't know this already, Clint has a new book of poetry that's coming out in March. We're very excited about it. We happen to have an advanced copy here. Above Ground is the title. It'll be released in March. Would you do us the honor of giving us a sample?
That'd be fun.
From your new book?
Let's do it. So this book comes out in March, and it has a very different emotional texture than the previous book. I think part of what happened is that, you know, I was thinking a lot about the role, like what it meant to be enslaved, what it meant to be an enslaved child, what it meant, what would it, I kept imagining myself in the context of slavery. You know, that what if I was me, but only a few generations ago, mm-hmm. and I was raising my children, but was raising my children in slavery. And so Navig thinking about the sort of moral and ethical and psychological implications of that. But something I think about all the time, I think about it as a writer, I think about it as a scholar, I think about it as a teacher, is how it's so important to deeply engage with the history of violence and oppression and intergenerational trauma that Black people have experienced. Mm-hmm. And it is so important to be clear that our experience and our lives as Black Americans are not singularly defined by that history, right. That they are far more expansive than that. They are far more, it's far more pluralistic than that. And there's far much, there's so much more, there's so much more to it. So all that to say, I was like, you know, given that so much of what I was thinking about in that book was the, you know, and in the Whitney chapter was slavery, you know, how children were impacted by slavery, mm-hmm. And how parents are thinking about raising enslaved children. I also wanted to, part of the impetus was to write a book that reflected on what it meant to, like all of the other parts of raising a child that are not grounded in oppression, yeah. You know, grounded in that violence. All right, so I'm going to read it. This poem is called Dance Party. Sometimes in the evenings after dinner, after spaghetti has been slurped and I have bribed the broccoli into their bellies, I give both of my children the look. When my eyes meet theirs, they know what time it is. They push in their chairs, they stretch their legs, and we move the table to the far end of the dining room to clear space for what we already know is coming. Alexa, play the post-dinner dance party playlist. And within minutes, and within seconds, Martha Wash's booming voice rolls like thunder over our bodies. Everybody dance now. The electronic keyboard and the drums meet in the middle of the room like two dinosaurs ready to claim this kitchen as their own. Immediately, the jumping begins, and my daughter is flinging her limbs like an offbeat octopus, hands slapping the air behind her as if she is trying to smack anyone who enters her sacred space. I turn around, and my son is doing the robot, or is being eaten by a robot, or is being trapped in a universe where robots take over the bodies of little boys in peanut butter and jelly pajamas. Nonetheless, there is a robot somewhere. My children, bless them, have not yet learned how to clap on the 2 and 4, so I laugh, but also cringe as their small hands make a mockery of the melody around them. Now, halfway through the song, everyone is jumping, and I, caught up in the ecstasy of this moment, fall to the ground and convince this no longer young body that it is a good idea to start doing the worm. And when my children see me, their eyes become pools of possibility. It is clear that they see this as a clarion call to climb onto my back. And now, here we are, this strange trifecta, this unlikely trio, a robot and an octopus riding on the back of a worm who will certainly need some Tylenol before bed. And it is at this moment that their mother comes home. And when she opens the door, everyone is screaming. The speakers are blasting, and the percussion is shaking every wall around us. We look up at her, and she looks down at us, and we have no explanation for this strange scene, only an invitation for her to join.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And the release date is March
28th.
March 28th.
Available for pre-order now.
And on that note, let's take some questions from our audience.
Hi. I just wondered what you thought, if you had any thoughts about, since you talked so much about the deflection of teaching of slavery, I just wondered if you had any thoughts about the Union League bestowing a gold medal on Ron DeSantis a couple days ago. you can say no.
Yeah. I mean, what I'll say is that I think it's a real, obviously it's a shame for a lot of reasons, but like I remember being a kid growing up in New Orleans and being inundated with all these messages about all the things that were wrong with Black people. Some explicit, some subtle, but just this pathology that I was inundated with, some from the politicians, some from the media. And I remember feeling so confused because I knew that what I was hearing was wrong, but I didn't know how to say it was wrong. I didn't have the language, the toolkit, the historical or sociological context with which to push back against it. And it wasn't until many years later that I started reading the history, the sociology, the science, the social science, the scholars, the artists, the journalists, you know, all of these people whose work helped me understand that the landscape of inequality in this country was created, and that it wasn't an inevitable facet of what certain communities look like, right? Again, this idea that I talked about at the beginning, this idea that one community looks one way and another community looks another way, is because of the things that have been done to or taken away from communities and are not the result of the people in those communities themselves. And I think we can forget how so many of our young people, unless we give them the tools with which to understand that, unless we give them the history with which to understand that, they will make assumptions based on the things that they are hearing, based on the things that they are seeing, that further perpetuate the sort of distorted notions of like why our country looks the way that it does today. I think all the time about this 1964 essay by James Baldwin called A Talk to Teachers. And it's based on a speech he gave to a group of New York City educators in 1963. And in it, what he says is, he's like, the role of the teacher is to help the black child understand that even though the world tells them they are criminal, the role of the teacher is to help that black child understand that it is not the child who is criminal, it is the history, and it's the society that created the circumstances that that child is forced to grow up in that is the real criminal. And when you take away the opportunity for a student to spend time in an AP African American history course, I mean, I just think of how different my sense of self would have been if I had access to that course when I was 16 or 17 years old. It wasn't until graduate school that I started learning some of the things that helped disabuse me of ideas that I didn't even realize I was still carrying. And I was a high school teacher, so I know what some of our young people are carrying. We had a drive-by shooting at our school, not at our school, but one of the students at the school I was teaching at in Prince George's County, Maryland, was killed in a drive-by shooting when I was there. And I remember the next day, you know, there was this mourning, there was this grief. But there was also this strange sense of like inevitability. I remember talking to one of my students about it, and he was just like, this is just what black people do, Smith. Like, this is just what happens. This is a black student telling me this, right? So it's like, what has the world told you about yourself to make you think that a student getting shot on their porch is an inevitable facet of what it means to be a black person in this country? And it is so important for young people, black young people, but all young people in this country, to have a firmer, more cohesive sense of what has shaped black life in this country. And it's just a real shame that that opportunity has been taken away from millions of young people. So I think it's a huge disservice. I have lots of, you know, non-PG things to say about it, but but it just makes me sad for those kids, you know, because it represents a real important opportunity that doesn't exist in a lot of schools.
So being a teacher in Philly and around for a while, one of the best debates we have is what Toni Morrison meant in the end of Beloved, with This Is Not a Story of the Past on. And I was, based upon the title of your book, whether you think was meant.
Do you want to provide context for folks who might not be familiar
with it? So the very end of the book, I believe it said three times, this is not a story of the pass on, this is not a story of the pass on, this is not a story of the pass on, and the story of the Beloved is similar to the story, or a story you mentioned when you were visiting the plantation of a mother who had to make that impossible choice.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Toni Morrison is, I think there is a reason that Beloved is the most famous and well-read book about slavery today. I mean, back in the day, it would have been Uncle Tom's Cabin. Thankfully, it's not that anymore. You know, it's. I'm always wary of trying to definitively interpret any artist's work. Like, I have a policy when students, I get lots of like Instagram DMs from students who are like, I got homework, man, and they're asking me what this poem is about. Like, what is the cicada? What is the cicada? Like, what is this? Is this a symbolism for, you know, all kind of... I'm like, man, you should, like, your school starts in 2 hours. What are you doing? But I don't share like what, you know, in a poem or anything, like what I meant from it, or what I meant by it, because what's much more interesting to me is like what the reader interprets it as. Like it's almost irrelevant what I, you know, intended with any line or intended with any word or any sort of linguistic or stylistic choice. And, you know, it's the same thing, like you have a thousand people look at the same painting and see a thousand different things. And I think that's the beauty of art. And so all to say, you know, that's a wonderful debate to have in your class, because it's like, there doesn't have to be a right answer. You know, there doesn't have to be like what this means this or this means, you know. So broadly, Toni Morrison is, you know, one of the most important writers in world history, and certainly one of the most important writers in shaping my own understanding of the possibilities of the craft. And, you know, what I'm interested in with that book is the way it depicts the like horror of having to make that sort of choice, right? Like what do you, it just is such an unfathomable position for so many of us to even imagine being in. You know, like how abhorrent, how horrific must the institution of slavery be for you to think that the best solution is to like kill your, to take the life of your child so she doesn't have to experience what you have experienced. And so, I think, you know, sitting with that without having to come up with a definitive answer necessarily. And this, I don't mean it as a cop-out, even though it sounds like a very extended, elongated cop-out. but, you know, I'm much more interested in the presentation of, like, the question itself, right? And, like, what it means to have to grapple, for students to even have to grapple with why that mother did that. Did they do it? Should they have done it? I miss that a bit, being a high school English teacher, right? Just, like, sitting around with a bunch of teenagers and, like, talking about good books. It's a beautiful thing. How many teachers are in the audience? Man, y'all always come through. Look at you. On a school night, too.
Yes.
On the same vein of being an English teacher, you mentioned earlier this is the type of book that you would want, you know, you would have liked to had when you were in high school. So I'm just curious, how do you see your book being used in a high school classroom, or how would you want it being seen? And I'm a little selfish because I get to make up my own curriculum. So, you know, help me out here.
That's a great question. You're like the teacher version of the kids sliding into my Instagram DMs. Like, what's the answer, Smith? You know, one of the things that I'm most interested in, one of the things I hope is one of the big takeaways from the book is this idea. You know, I started this book thinking about how visiting different places would help me understand our collective physical proximity to the history of slavery, how the scars of slavery are etched into the landscape all around us. And in doing so, I think what happened is that I got a clearer sense of our collective temporal proximity to that history, how this history that we tell ourselves was a long time ago just wasn't that long ago at all. And I think about the epilogue with my grandparents, my granddad born in 1930, Jim Crow, Mississippi, my grandmother born in 1939, Jim Crow, Florida. And I'm pushing my grandfather in his wheelchair, and my grandmother's walking a few paces ahead of us as we walk through the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And I'm sort of observing them observe the museum and watching them, you know, watch these exhibits, and thinking about how so much of the history of violence that's documented in this museum are things that they experienced firsthand. And I think about the woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture, a woman named Ruth Bonner, in 2016, alongside the Obama family. She rang the bell to sort of signal the opening of the museum. She was the daughter of an enslaved person, not the granddaughter, not the great-granddaughter. She was the daughter of someone who was born into chattel slavery. My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. So when my five-year-old son sits on my grandfather's lap, I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap, And again, I'm just reminded that this history that we've been told is a long time ago just wasn't that long ago at all. I was taught about slavery like it was something that happened in the Jurassic period. Like it was like the Flintstones, the dinosaurs and slavery all together. But like there are people alive today who knew, who loved, who were raised by people who were born into slavery. I think all the time about this trip I took to England. And I went to England and we went a few years ago, and one of the places we visited was Oxford University. And, you know, very fancy university, very famous. And we were getting this tour, and the tour guide was like, this famous poet wrote this poem in this building. This famous scientist did this experiment in this building. And this famous philosopher wrote this treatise in this building. And he came to one building, and he looked at the building and looked at us and looked at the building and looked at us. And he was like, this building was built around 1020. And I was like, AM or PM? Like, I couldn't even conceive of this building that had been built a millennium ago. Function like being something that people walked in and out of. But I bring that up because it's a reminder that the U.S.'s history is so young and it's so recent compared to the rest of the world. We're like the annoying preteen of the world. And for me, interviewing my grandparents and having a formal structure to the conversation that I was having with them gave me insight into my own proximity to that history in a way that I hadn't had before. And so all of that's a long way of saying something I would be interested in seeing is like, what does it look like for our students to interview their elders? What would it look like for them? And sometimes that's your grandparents. Sometimes that's the woman who lives next door. Sometimes that's the lady at church. Sometimes, I mean, it can take on all different forms. But I think there are so many people around us who have lived through these profound moments in American history, who have a proximity and an intimacy to that history and that moment that we could benefit from learning from. And that would give us additional insight into our own relationship to that history, especially if, like, there are so many stories, some of which are documented in the book, some of which are not, that, like, I just never knew about my grandparents. Like, my grandfather was born in a town where, like, somebody was lynched when he was 12 years old, right? This is a town of 1,000 people. He knew this person. Right, so like, what does it mean to grow up as a kid in like 1930, 1940 Mississippi, and a man you knew in your town was lynched and castrated? Like, and what does it mean that, you know? And he told me the story that's in the book about he went to pick something up from the grocery store, and the two white guys who were working at the grocery store were like, if you want to take your groceries, like, you need to dance for us, and like the fear and anger that I saw in this 92-year-old man's face. From a memory from when he was like 10 years old. I just never knew that part of his story. I never knew that part of his life. And it's just so important, I think, to understand where folks have been and what they've experienced to the extent that they feel comfortable sharing it. And I just think it's like a very helpful exercise both for the interviewer and the interviewee, because my grandparents were also excavating things that they hadn't thought about in a long time. So if there was one assignment from the book, I think having students interview elders in their family or in their community would be the thing that I would advocate for.
Hey, I'm a U.S. history teacher from Alabama. I wrote my question.
Oh, amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. In Counting Descent, you write, I still believe we can build this world into something new. And I love that, and I believe that. But then at the end of How the Word is Passed, you write, at some point, it is no longer a question of whether we can learn this history, but whether we have the collective will to reckon with it. And I look around, and sometimes I don't see that path to that collective will. And so, like, how do you see that path to the collective will to teach the truth and to create something new?
Yeah, thank you for that question, and thank you for your work. I think all the time about how the first enslaved people who came to this country, you know, or the British colonies that would become this country came in 1619. Emancipation Proclamation, you know, didn't happen until 1863. Civil War didn't end until 1865. And so, you know, slavery existed in this country for about 250 years. But what's true is that from the moment enslaved people arrived on these shores, they were fighting for freedom. They were fighting for liberation. They were fighting for emancipation. What that also means is that the vast majority of people who fought for freedom never got a chance to experience it for themselves. but they fought for it anyway because they knew that someday someone would. And I think about how my life is only possible, how my children's lives are only possible because of generations of people who fought for something they knew they might never see, but they fought for it anyway because they knew that someday someone would. And I think about what sort of responsibility does that bestow upon me? Does that bestow upon us to attempt to build the sort of world that we might not see ourselves, that our children might not see themselves, that their children might not see themselves, but to work toward building it anyway because that's what was done for us. And it's like we're all chipping away at this wall, and you don't know if the wall is 6 inches thick or 600,000 miles thick, but you know the more you chip away at it, the less the people who come after you will have to chip away at. And so what I mean is that sometimes, you know, and I think this is true in the context of teaching, I think this is true in the context of so many jobs and occupations and people who orient themselves toward justice, who orient themselves toward building a more equitable, egalitarian world, that it can so often feel like things aren't moving and that things aren't changing and that sometimes that things are going backwards. And I think part of what I always try to keep in mind is that, like, even when you don't know how far the other side of that wall is, or how far it extends, or when you'll see the light on the other side of it, you know that the more chipping away that you do, the less the people who come after you will have to chip away at. And I think that that's what the best teachers do, right? And it's hard because on some days, you know, you don't know what's working. On some days, you feel despondent. On some days, it feels, you know, like you don't know to what extent what you're saying is like coming through, but you have to believe that it is, and you have to keep, you know, obviously be generous with yourself and gracious with yourself, and afford yourself the sort of extend to yourself the sort of generosity you would want to extend that you would extend to other people. But it makes a difference, even when you can't see it. It really does. Yes, ma'am.
What about reparations? That would be a big chip.
Quickie?
I'm a senior.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll ever see reparations.
You said it was a quickie.
Money or land?
You're right. You're right. You're right. She's like, what am I going to get? So I think I appreciate your question. There's a lot to the abbreviated version. I think that it can't be the case that there have been decades and decades and centuries in which black people have been explicitly prevented from having access to the levers of upward mobility in this country that have kept them saturated in spaces of poverty and violence that they can't escape. And then try to create interventions to fix that don't specifically target the very people who were previously targeted in a harmful way. And so we absolutely need reparations. I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert on the sort of specific financial manifestations of that. There are people like the economist Sandy Darity at Duke University does a lot of work around reparations and imagining what a specific program or set of programs might look like. What I'm interested in is ensuring that when we talk about reparations, we're talking not only about the material interventions, but we're also talking about the sort of educational interventions and the interventions of memory, right? Because you can't create programs that allot money and funding and resources to groups of people without educating the sort of broader public about why such interventions are necessary. Because then you only create a wider chasm of misunderstanding, a wider chasm of, and I think we already have seen in very explicit, violent ways, you know, I'm thinking of January 6th, of what happens when there are people who believe there are folks who are getting something they don't deserve. And so I think that, like, if you, in a sort of resource, reallocation of material resources without a reimagining or recalibration of our collective consciousness, would potentially lead to even more violence and conflict. But I want to answer your question real quick as well. Thank you for your question.
Thank you both for your time. I'm a fellow alum of Davidson.
Hey! Davidson folks.
And I was wondering, what can colleges and universities across the country do to recognize symbols of racism and slavery while educating students, alum, members of the community? Like what comes to mind is how at Davidson, the main academic building, is named after a former slave owner.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tricky, and I think it has to be decided on like a hyper-local level. I don't think there's any sort of broad policy that you can, you know, wave a wand and say every university needs to do this specific thing. I think every university's history is different. You know, I've been in conversation with people who are making some of the decisions around this at Davidson. I've been on some of the sort of task force and committees thinking about what the symbolism or iconography and new monuments and new artist developments meant to commemorate that history look like. I think that it's kind of, you know, these two questions are kind of in conversation with each other because I think there are material interventions that are necessary. Like, who are the descendants of the people who were harmed? Who are the descendants of the people who built this space? Or who, you know, you think about Chambers, like, who are the descendants of the people that Chambers enslaved, who made his wealth possible, that made it so that he could, you know, donate all this money to this university? And so thinking about what sort of reallocation resources can you allot toward those people whose ancestors experienced that harm, but also thinking about what sort of broader commitment does Davidson have or need to have as it reflects their relationship to the larger Black community that surrounds Davidson so that they can continue to be proactive and not reactive in creating like a more dynamic, equitable relationship between a community that is often prevented from having access to the resources that Davidson has. And then, but also like, you know, there should be, every student who comes to Davidson should be taught, and I'm just using Davidson as an example because that's our alma mater, every student who comes to Davidson should be taught specifically about the history that shaped Davidson and that created Davidson, right? And that can be a class, that can be an orientation, that can be in Davidson 101 or whatever the case may be. And it's, you know, Harvard, my other alma mater, is like wrestling with the same set of questions, you know? And I think each school needs to look at itself. But the most important thing, and this goes all the way back to what we were talking about with Monticello, there's not a thing where it's like you build the monument or you take the name off the building and add a new name to the building, or, you know, or you put up a plaque and you get to sort of wipe your hands of it and be like, okay, we did the thing. This work that you do for the rest of your life as an individual, as an institution, there is no sort of like you lay the wreath or you say the thing and you're done with it. And that's the problem, is that sometimes people are looking for a way to not have to deal with it anymore, when actually what you have to do is deal with it for the rest of the existence of your institution. And so I think that is the most important thing, is a reflection of understanding that the process necessitates like proactive, everyday, ongoing reflection at all times.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.